From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Well, here's something you should take notice if you are on the cholesterol-lowering drug Vytorin. Federal drug safety regulators say they are investigating whether this cholesterol-lowering drug, Vytorin, can increase patients' risk of developing cancer. Now, the Food and Drug Administration did say patients should not stop taking Vytorin because the evidence of a cancer link is still unclear. While one recent clinical trial indicated higher rates of cancer for patients taking the medication, two studies currently underway have shown no increased risk. Consumers worried about salad safety may soon be able to buy fresh spinach and iceberg lettuce zapped with just enough radiation to kill E. coli and other germs. The Food and Drug Administration will issue a new regulation allowing spinach and lettuce sellers to take the extra step, a long-awaited move amid increasing outbreaks from raw produce. What does this mean to us? Jeff Nelkin, food safety expert. Jeff, is this a good thing or a bad thing to radiate the food, the spinach, the lettuce?
Well, you know, the history goes back quite a few years in the early 70s, and I think people got kind of scared off from the whole process, basically because of the nuclear connection, I guess, the radiation type thing. So the whole program was not marketed very well. So it's exciting to see that, you know, this research has gotten to the point where, you know, produce can be treated with electrons and salmonella and E. coli can be killed.
Do you think it'll do the job, Jeff?
If it's handled correctly, and it's more, I think it's going to be a big marketing package because keep in mind the American public was very gun-shy for the last 30 years. So I think it's going to take everyone coming together, the academic community, produce industry, and, you know, everybody working together to make the public feel comfortable, you know, with this process.
All right. That's Jeff Nelkin, foodsafetycoach.com. In Arizona, officials say a mysterious malady has killed more than 40 head of cattle that had been grazing in a pasture in Chino Valley. The cattle were found dead early Wednesday, and ranchers spent the day burying the carcasses. Officials with the Arizona Department of Agriculture are investigating the case, and specialists from several state agencies were at the scene. An Agriculture Department spokesperson says it appears the animals may have died from some sort of plant toxicity. No signs of foul play. More than 150 other cattle in the pasture were not harmed. A new investigation. It says that a raging, long-burning fire caused the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7, which tumbled hours after hijacked jets hit the Twin Towers on September 11, 2001. The National Institute of Standards and Technology found that the 47-story building, which stood right next to the Towers 1 and 2, caught fire due to the debris that flew into it after the plane struck. It eventually fell after 7 hours due to instability caused by the fire, not by explosives, as some theorists have claimed. This is a debate that will go on and on. The U.S. is fed up with Moscow's delay in withdrawing from the war-torn Georgia, and they've demanded that Russian troops leave Georgia now. The White House demand came amid growing tensions between the West and Russia, which is accused of violating its promise to pull its military from the region. The mother of missing Orlando toddler Kaylee Anthony walked out of jail with her lawyer, swarmed by reporters after her $500,000 bond was posted the previous night. Casey Anthony, 22 years old, will have to wear an ankle monitor now that she is released, which happened Thursday morning at about 10:30 a.m. She was huddled under an umbrella in the rain and taken to the home of her parents. Celebrity bail bondsman Tony Padilla said his company posted the hefty bond for Anthony, who remains a person of interest in the disappearance of her daughter. Kaylee has been missing more than 2 months. Today, Major Ed Dame sent me an email. He says that he and his remote viewing group, they found Kaylee. They know where she is. It's not a happy ending. I'm not going to tell you the results of the story, because Major Ed Dames has sent the information to law enforcement, and until they follow up on it, I'm not going to say anything about that yet. Folks in Florida warned to beware of alligators in their flooded streets as Tropical Storm Fay poured more rain on the Sunshine State's central Atlantic coast, pushing creatures of all kinds from their homes. Alligators, snakes, and other wildlife were spotted in some soaked neighborhoods after high water drove the animals from their normal lairs. Boy, how'd you like to be walking across the street when that happened? On the coasttocoastam.com website, Hot Stories, take a look at the picture of the North Carolina man who made a record catch with a very toy Barbie fishing pole that belonged to his daughter. She said, "Here, hold the rod while I go to the bathroom." Well, he felt something on the other end, pulled it up. It was a 21-pound, 1-ounce state record channel catfish. You'll see the picture. It's bigger than the little girl, as a matter of fact. The next time you forget to return a couple of library books and ignore those annoying letters from the overdue status, think of Heidi Dalibor from Wisconsin. She's been arrested because she had two overdue books. The fine was $180. Police went to her home and took her to jail. The Bigfoot hoaxers, Rick Dyer and Matthew Whitten, they're back in the limelight again, blaming now the California promoter, you know his name, who trotted them out for a nationally televised press conference last Friday. Back in Georgia, they told a couple television stations the entire affair was just a joke. It got out of hand. You can expect litigation there. Iran intends to send its first astronaut into space within the next decade. The Republic is believing that they can get an astronaut up there within 10 years. And now I have to wish happy birthday to our dear friend Ray Bradbury, who on Friday will be 88 years old. Happy birthday, Ray.
Well, thank you so much.
This is just incredible. Of course, you being the science fiction genius, somebody that we have admired on this program for so many years, Ray.
And I'm a great playwright, too. In fact, in October the 15th, I'm reopening my play, Fahrenheit 451, in South Pasadena at the Fremont Theater. So I'm a great playwright also.
Oh, you are great, everything you touch. Ray, tell me, how did this all start for you? How did your mind get into the mysteries of science fiction? Did this start when you were a little boy?
I read Tarzan. I read the Martian books of Edgar Rice Burroughs. And when I wrote my first story, it was a sequel to the books of Edgar Rice Burroughs, all about Mars.
Do you feel 88 years old, Ray?
I'm 12 years old tonight.
Very good. Ray, we love you here. Take care of yourself.
I will. Thank you very much.
Happy birthday, Raymond Bradbury. Born on August 22nd, 1920, still going strong. In a moment, Richard Hoagland joins us for a special four-hour program about anti-gravity, free energy, space exploration, and just about everything else from the author of Dark Mission. Richard Hoagland next on Coast to Coast AM. Full program with Richard C. Hoagland. Later on in the program, Joseph Farrell will join Richard C. as we talk about gravity, anti-gravity, free energy, space exploration. Of course, you know Richard C. Hoagland is the former Space Science Museum curator, worked for CBS News during the historic Apollo missions to the moon. He has written the best-selling book, Dark Mission, heads up the enterprisemission.com, and also is our science advisor. And Richard, you just heard our little happy birthday greeting to Ray Bradbury. Now we've got another one. Last week, your significant other, Robin Falkov, her
That's
birthday.
Right.
Shall we? Hey, by the way, sometime tonight, I'm going to put you on the spot. Because when I was in Santa Maria at a special UFO conference last weekend, a partner of yours, whose name will go unmentioned,
yes,
said that you were one of the greatest opera singers he has ever heard. Is this true, or was he pulling my leg?
Slightly pulling your leg. I actually was on Columbia Records with my brothers and sisters. We had a group called The Foregone Conclusion.
You're kidding me.
No, I was at the other end of CBS on the CBS label, simultaneous with advising Cronkite and the space unit and special events on going to the moon and all that. And I brought everyone together at a very famous Christmas party, which was the Christmas party celebrating the Apollo 8 you know, Lunar Around the Moon, Incredible Extravaganza. And I sang a very special song to one of the producers that I hated.
You, Richard?
In this party.
That's funny. Hey, isn't it cool to be able to wish Ray Bradbury a happy
88th? Oh, that is so cool. And yeah, of course he's not 88. He's 8.
He's 8.
You know, the thing that keeps all of us young is that we're too dumb to grow up. We actually think the world can be, you know, maneuvered into our visions, our dreams, our projections, the way it should be. And Ray is at the top of that list.
Absolutely.
And obviously, you know, when I was growing up, I read him vociferously. And in Monuments, I give an appropriate homage to, you know, the impact he had on me and the impressions that he left. So, you know, happy birthday, Ray. May you have another 88 at least.
And you know what keeps you young? You just keep working. Like he said, he's you know, doing his play, Fahrenheit 451. You just have to keep working, Richard. I think once you stop, that's when you get old.
Did you have, was it you or was it someone else? Maybe it was on Larry King. Somebody had a guest who had actually, you know, done a professional university-level study on this, and they find that 9-to-5ers who reach retirement age 65 and go home, a lot of them have heart attacks within 2 or 3 weeks and they die.
We had just a copy story on that a long time ago, not a guest.
Yeah, no, there's a serious study. In fact, there are many studies that show that if you're committed, you remain involved, you don't think of your job as a job, but as a profession, a career, a life choice, something that is really part of you, you're a whole lot healthier and a whole lot better than if you come home every night and say, oh, I can't stand the damn thing. And then when you quit, you have nothing in your life, and you basically get bored and you die.
You wither away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe
so obviously
that.
You and I are going to be around forever.
Gosh, I don't know about that, but we're going to give it our best, aren't we?
We will give it our best shot.
Hey, tonight, we've got just a few moments before the break, but give us highlights on some of these incredible things we're talking about tonight. You know, I spent the better part of today looking at your Wernher von Braun story on theenterprisemission.com, and I got to tell you, I was not aware of that story at all, which we'll talk about tonight.
I know. Well, you and I have done a million shows.
Yes,
well,
we
maybe
have.
Not a million.
Well, but close.
And Art and I did easily over a million.
2 million.
I will say, without fear or contradiction, that I think tonight's show that we're going to do, the next 4 hours and change, is probably the most important show I have ever done on Coast. And the reason I say that is because, apart from all the other evidence of unusual things and evidence that they've been hiding and artifacts and all that, the evidence we're going to talk about tonight and the implications of that evidence is absolutely incontrovertible. This is official NASA data. There's no question about the numbers, about the specifics. Anybody can check it. The implications of what it means have not been thought of by anybody, apparently, publicly until we figured this out. Later in the show, I'm going to read you some emails from some of the old-timers, the old rocket guys,
mm-hmm.
who actually have worked on these programs, who worked on them with von Braun, who are basically confirming to me that we have figured it out, and they were sworn to secrecy never to talk about this. This is an extraordinary discovery. It's an extraordinary scandal because NASA, which picked up the cudgels from the Army and von Braun's early efforts to put a satellite into orbit, supposedly an open public civilian agency, kept this secret, knowing full well that they had to figure it out, otherwise we could never have gone to the moon, and we'll talk about the details of that. All the way up and down the line, people have simply turned their heads, ignored the implications of what's right in front of them, and the startling implications of what it could mean for everybody listening to my voice now, as well as every single human being on this planet. So I don't think it's hyperbole, and we'll obviously get emails at the end of the evening if people don't agree, but I don't think it's hyperbole for me to say that this may be one of the, if not the most important show that certainly you and I have ever done.
A couple, several weeks ago, I saw what definitely happened to be my first UFOs when I was at another conference in San Jose.
And you know that Robin had a similar sighting here?
Really?
She, based on your effusive, you know, discussion of the night vision and what you saw,
right,
went down to Tesla Tech and met up with George Gabori and Charles Osman and Bill Alec and a bunch of other guys on the roof, I guess, of the hotel. Apparently the roofs of hotels at these conferences are a great place to hang out.
Oh, yeah, they really are.
And somebody had brought a very high-tech, very expensive, like $4,000 pair of these.
That's third generation.
Third generation, yeah. Night vision amplification, you know, infrared, whatever. And they're standing on the roof looking, and they're seeing all kinds of weird, amazing things in the skies over Albuquerque, the land of enchantment, going back and forth in 90-degree and zigzags and all that. And then a huge boomerang flies over the hotel, trailing other objects around it, like they're escorting it, like what was reported during the whole Phoenix incident,
right,
back in 1997.
Only visible with those binoculars?
With night vision, which, yeah, amplifies both starlight and the upward beams of the scattered light from,
yeah,
the cities. But you can't see it with the naked eye. Now,
no,
we're here in really, really dark skies in the northeast part of the city. And what I'm going to try to do is to get someone in our audience, hint, hint, to loan me a beta version of these glasses so we can actually not only see some things, but maybe record them with TV, because we've got
You can do that with the guns. And the beta version now would be a fourth generation,
yeah,
that they're working on,
yeah,
which are supposed to be phenomenal.
And, of course, you know my thesis that they were not talking about UFOs. We're talking about the secret.
I was just going to ask you if you think what we've been looking at might be that, the secret program.
Did I send you a picture that one of my sources sent me a couple weeks ago?
You sent me a picture of me and Mike Berra at the San Jose thing.
No, this was a couple weeks ago.
No.
Okay, I was sent from Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines from 1972 by a master sergeant who was stationed on the base, the most astonishing, quote, color UFO picture you have ever seen, except it's not a UFO.
What is it?
It's clearly one of ours. It is a boomerang-shaped, obviously secret space program spacecraft hovering at a rakish angle over the nuclear weapons storage facility on Clark Air Force Base, and it comes to me through a very important and credible series of sources and connections.
If what we're going to talk about is accurate, and I know you believe it is.
Well, but no, you don't have to believe me. Just go Google on these orbits, and we'll explain.
Okay, you can explain that to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
what I want you to do, by the way, is I want you to stop me every time I get into a term that you don't understand or you think someone out there doesn't understand.
All right.
Because it's really important that everybody get this. This is incredibly significant, and I don't want anybody to miss any of the cool parts of it.
Well, just do what you've always done, like Michio Kaku does. Speak in terms that I understand.
And you will tell me.
And we'll be okay then.
If I don't, yes.
But I think what this does, in the case you're building, is you're backing up why there's a secret program going on.
Well, yeah, because unlike the photographs that we talk about, there's no room for interpretation here. When you launch a satellite into space, according to 300-year-old Newton's laws and Kepler's, the dynamics are incredibly simple. I mean, they're so simple that even a high school kid can figure them out. That's how simple they're supposed to be. What happened with the first satellite that Wernher von Braun and his team of Operation Paperclip imported German Nazi engineers.
That was Explorer 1?
Explorer 1. Back in January 31, the late evening, 10:48 in the evening Eastern Time of January 31, 1958. Think back how old you were then.
I was 8.
Von Braun launched this satellite into orbit. And the story we're going to then unfold through the rest of this 4 hours is what happened when it reached space and did things that no self-respecting Newtonian law-abiding satellite should ever have done.
And they didn't expect it.
They didn't expect it. They knew that it was incredibly impossible, And there was a conspiracy, which I'm going to demonstrate, to cover it up from the highest to the lowest levels of this government and the other governments, including the Soviet Union, including the Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese. Everybody is in on the secret, except the ordinary, common, everyday guy here in the U.S. who paid for those missions and all the subsequent missions. And we're going to describe in detail what happened that night, what von Braun did following what happened that night, which lets us know that he knew it was incredibly impossible.
And we're going to do that in just a moment. Richard C. Hoagland, our special guest throughout the evening tonight. A little bit later on in the program, Joseph Farrell joins us to add his expertise. Then, of course, in the final hour, Richard and Joseph will take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie here with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, I guess for us to begin, we must start at the beginning as Operation Paperclip, these brains of Germany, so many of them Nazis, came over here with their knowledge. Go ahead.
Well, they were all Nazis. You know, I mean, there was nobody in Germany who couldn't be, because certainly if you had a position of responsibility, if you were involved heavily in engineering and science, helping Hitler win the war, helping the Reich, you know, perpetuate its thousand-year mythology, they didn't, for security reasons, let anybody in those positions do any of this amazing stuff that wasn't a Nazi.
Were they diehard Nazis, though, Richard, or...
See, that's what everybody keeps excusing these guys for. Of course they were.
Yeah.
Duh. What we did when we brought them over here is that we sanitized them. We, you know, there used to be the term in the intel community called sheep dipping.
Uh-huh.
We sheep dip them all. If you read their actual dossiers, if you go back and you actually read, which I've been able to do, because I've had my own researchers in the National Archives, you know, extracting this paperwork for years, like Joseph has, as you'll see when we have him on toward the end of the show, you can actually read the U.S. Army intel guys who were, you know, doing the interviews and basically trying to see whether these guys were going to be threats to the United States if they brought them over here. And the unwhitewashed version of von Braun's dossier, where he was a major in the SS, et cetera, reads very differently, with the interrogator basically saying could be security risk, et cetera, than the sheep dip version that we've all, you know, been privy to because of NASA propaganda for the last 50 years.
All right, so the Russians beat us. How did they beat us? Did they get the better Nazis?
You mean they beat us in the space?
In the space.
No, they didn't. And this is another mythology which we don't really get into in part one. This is going to be a three-part series, you know, von Braun's 50-year-old secret. Part one is already posted on Enterprise.
Right.
Part two, I literally finished 20 minutes ago. I sent it to Joseph to kind of read over because, you know, he has the background that is, you know,
sure,
their expertise in this. He's given me the green light, so sometime either during the show or at the very end, I'll post part two. Part three is going to be about some of the very strange politics that we've, again, been lied to. It is so obvious now that we let the Russians beat us. We could have beaten them. There are all kinds of examples of twists and turns of history and fate and all the other misimpressions we've been given, you know. History, as they keep saying, is written by the winners. Well, in this case, the winners are the ones who were in the White House, who were writing the history right after the so-called Sputnik surprise. We, the Eisenhower people, deliberately allowed Russia to beat us into space.
Because why?
Ah. Now, you want me to get into the politics of this first, or you want to back into it later?
Give me a highlight of it, because
okay,
this fascinates
me. The reason was, is that Eisenhower was pushing very strongly what he called his open skies proposal. He wanted, because we were very concerned about the development of nuclear weapons and you know, bombers and the beginnings of missiles in the Soviet Union, just like we were developing them here. That's why the paperclip guys were brought over, to help the Army develop better versions of the V-2 so we could lob nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union and basically create what was called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. If they started a fight, we'd clobber them, and if we started the fight, they would clobber us.
No,
so
nobody
it was
wins.
Basically the Mexican standoff. You know, you got two guys standing in a pool of gasoline in a dark basement, and both have pistols, and if either one fires the shot, they both incinerate.
The Russians seem to have forgotten that in this latest incursion with Georgia.
Well, because it's a threshold thing.
Yeah.
They're only nibbling at their own borders. They're not threatening us directly, and we're not going to do anything. At least that's their
perception.
Their, reasoning.
Yeah.
So we had this standoff, and Eisenhower, because we had nothing in those days. We had, you know, we had basically ground-based human intelligence. That was it. We didn't have airplanes. We didn't have satellites. We didn't have ways to look down. We didn't have real independent technical, what they call national technical means, to verify how many bombers, how many missile bases, how many missiles, et cetera, et cetera. We basically would count the missiles during the May Day parades in front of the Kremlin, which, of course, a lot of them were cardboard.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So there was this real effort on the part of Eisenhower, who was a general, remember, to get real intelligence. So he came up with this idea called Open Skies, where he basically put it up to Khrushchev, look, if you open your skies to reconnaissance, we'll open our skies, and that way both sides will know what each other's got, and we won't go to war over a misimpression or an accident or a mistake.
Interesting.
And the Russians turned him down. Soviets kept turning him down. What he didn't want, in hindsight, and the historians now are kind of freely admitting this, it hasn't leaked out into the general mythos yet. What he didn't want was for von Braun and the army guys to put up something called Project Orbiter, which had been begun as an idea in 1954. Remember, the Sputnik shock was in October 57.
Right.
In 54, they were discussing putting satellites into orbit. The Navy had some ideas. The Army had some ideas. The Army had von Braun, which was their ace in the hole. And he was very upset that he was turned down by McElroy, who was the Department of Defense Secretary, working under the White House, of course, under Eisenhower, and by Eisenhower himself, because the von Braun guys couldn't imagine why we would want to allow the Soviets to get ahead, and the Soviets had already published that they were going to launch a satellite. Now, the popular wisdom is that our guys didn't take them seriously. Oh, those stupid backwards commies, they couldn't, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
and we got stuck.
Wrong,
we got
wrong,
caught.
Wrong.
Not the case.
Again, more lies. What really was going on is that the White House deliberately would not let von Braun launch a military satellite over the Soviet Union, because what they wanted was a civilian satellite, either by the Navy, under the guise of Vanguard, a separate private, you know, research effort.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, worst case scenario, the Soviets would do it first, and then we would not object. And if we didn't object, then in the court of public opinion nationally, internationally, in the UN, et cetera, the open skies would certainly extend at least to satellite altitudes. And that would have given us the green light to fly over the Soviet Union territory with spy satellites that were on the drawing boards, Project Corona. The CIA was busily trying to put together a way to put spacecraft into orbit with film cameras. And then they would literally re-enter the warhead or the spacecraft and pluck the film out of the water, develop it, and take a look at high-resolution images of bombers and missile bases and all that. Well, this whole open skies idea was to basically let the Russians go first so that we would then have the political excuse that they could no longer claim that space was verboten.
Knowing that we could go at just about any time we wanted.
Exactly. Now, that's a complete 180 from everything you've ever been told, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first time I've heard it.
NASA, never a straight answer. So, I mean, Mike and I wrote a book called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, where the mantra in the book is, the lie is different at every level. Remember, that was given to me by one of my best intel sources.
Now, did the Russians have a von Braun German counterpart that they got, the cream of the crop?
They
didn't have
a Russian guy
named
Korolev, Sergei Korolev, who was a genius, homegrown, who, of course, Stalin had thrown into the gulag. you know, Stalin threw all their best guys into the gulag, and those that survived and came out did incredibly amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
Like Kolyarov is one of them. Kozyrev, the guy who basically invented torsion field physics, is another, who spent, I know, 20, 30 years in the gulag because of Stalin. The Russians did not treat their own talent, their own geniuses, very well. And still, these guys came out and worked their hearts out. Korolev actually was the genius who built the Russian ICBM force and who said to Khrushchev, you know, we really could launch a satellite with this thing. And Khrushchev kind of said with his left finger, well, if it doesn't interfere with, you know, making sure the Americans don't get ahead of us in missiles,
right,
go ahead. He never had, nobody seemed to have a clue as to how the planet would go wild with whatever nation launched the first satellite into orbit, neither the Russians nor the Americans. And it was this little fencing game that Eisenhower was playing to be politically correct so that he could then put satellites over the Soviet Union, look down with cameras, and they couldn't politically do a damn thing. They also, by the way, couldn't blow them up. They did not have anti-satellite technology. So it was all about public posturing. It was all about how it would appear at the UN, the court of public opinion around the world. Propaganda was a lot more important in those days than apparently it is these days. I mean, look at how Russia, how Putin seems to not give a damn about what the world thinks. He's just going to do what he's going to do.
He's going to do what he's going to do this time. That's true.
So that's the background to the shock on October 4th, 1957, late at night, during a party at the Russian embassy for a whole bunch of high-level space planners from the White House and the NRL and the Navy and the Army in Washington. They were having this little reception, and suddenly somebody runs in and said, the Russians have just put a satellite into orbit.
Uh-huh.
It's on Radio Moscow. And everybody, of course, cheers and they raise their glasses, toast them, and that was the beginning of the space race.
They wanted that to happen.
They wanted that to happen. Now, if you want to really get high-level conspiratorial, of course, we would never go there.
Not
right?
Us.
No, not us.
Definitely not you.
What if there were some really bright guys around Eisenhower who realized that the big, fat, complacent Americans, if they did let von Braun put a satellite up, would stay big, fat, and complacent, and we would ultimately lose the bigger game, because if the Russians were second, there'd be no spur, no shock, no real, you know.
There's nothing like ketchup, right?
Exactly. And it was an incredible blow to our pride. And there's nothing like a blow to your pride to make you, you know, turn from Avis into Hertz. So I think that there was a combination of Eisenhower wanting to do the real politik, that is, get the Russians where he wanted them, which was a satellite over the U.S. territory that we would not object to, which would give him his carte blanche to do open skies and satellites, because the Russians had already turned down his proposal for aircraft like the U-2.
Which is what they got eventually. They got the carte blanche, didn't they?
Well, yeah, because when the Russians launched on a military ICBM, making it a military project, because there were no civilians in the Soviet Union.
Of course, we also launched on a military Redstone, didn't we?
That's right. The Jupiter C was a converted Redstone, but by then, remember, they'd gone first. And we didn't object. In fact, what did Eisenhower say at that first press conference? He dismissed Sputnik as that silly little bauble and basically downplayed any strategic significance to the Russian feat at all.
Because what did Sputnik do once they launched it? It just made some beeps and then...
Well, it had a radio transmitter. It had no scientific instruments, as far as I can remember. It was basically a basketball-sized aluminized sphere with four antennas sticking out of it. It went around the world in little, I don't know, maybe 100 and some minutes. I forget what the orbit was right now. And what it did was it fell back to Earth within a couple, 3 weeks or a month, I think.
And it had no propulsion system to it, right?
Kind of, no.
It was just a ball.
It was launched by its own carrier rocket and then set free. But it was just a weightless object careening around the Earth, falling eternally around the Earth, which is what a satellite orbit is, where the Earth is basically curving out from underneath it so it never hits the ground again, until the atmospheric resistance, the friction up there, even at about a couple hundred miles, brought it back down.
And it burned up. That was it.
Exactly. Its total value was symbolic. And what it did was to make America, every American, from, you know, Harvard down to the lowliest janitor working some night shift, God knows where, think that we were second.
My father, I remember my father, who at that time was working for Ford Motor Company, came home, and he was, you know, the old country type parents, who, by the way, celebrated yesterday their 59th wedding anniversary.
Oh, my. Congratulations.
But, I mean, it was, you know, when he came home from work, he stayed home. They stayed with the family. Very rarely did everybody go out later. You know, you went out on weekends. And, you know, when he came home, he came home, took his shoes off. We all had dinner, and we stayed home as a family. I remember him coming home, and then when the news broke, maybe it was the next day, about Sputnik, he had this look on his face that I can't describe. He wasn't scientific by any means, but he was an American. You know, he was in World War II. And he had this look, Richard, of someone who had been beaten, defeated, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah, it was like a Packer fan watching Vince Lombardi lose.
Yeah, they just couldn't believe it.
It was inconceivable, and oh my God, these backward commies had shown. I mean, it was such a shock to our ego.
And then he's trying to explain to a 7-year-old kid what this was. And he didn't even know. Other than whatever happened, we don't have one. At least that's what his perception was. And
yeah, it was like we no longer had the right stuff in a time when we hadn't even coined that phrase.
Yeah. And then people actually, Americans who were on top of this story, they were afraid.
Yes.
They didn't understand what this was. The Russians have gone into space. You know, they just didn't know. It was amazing. It was an amazing time.
Well, the more perspicacious realized that if the Russians could put a bauble into orbit going around and around the Earth, they could also lob nuclear weapons with those same rockets to hit any American city they wanted.
That's true.
And remember, I lived through duck and cover. You know, I heard constant reports about the bombers and the dew line and, you know, keeping a watch over the Arctic and, you know, invasion threats. And I mean, it was an incredibly paranoid time. And for the Russians to suddenly upstage us, again, you know, every time someone says to me that I'm not following the dumbness model, that even people in positions of authority can be really dumb and stupid,
mm-hmm.
I say to them in counterpoint, look, if people in positions of authority were that dumb and stupid, then billions of people would be dead tonight because the world wouldn't keep running. When you know, to paraphrase Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when you see something happen in politics, it is not coincidence. It's by plan and design.
And you know we don't believe.
And now I know that this was by plan and design.
Yep.
At the very least, because Eisenhower wanted open skies, this was how he was going to get it. And at the worst-case scenario, somebody realized that if Americans took their licking and were second, for the first time in their modern history, it would galvanize, just like World War II, just like
Pearl Harbor. Yep.
Awoke as the Japanese, what was it, who was the admiral who planned the invasion?
Who
said, you know, we've just committed a terrible mistake because we've awakened a sleeping giant.
Sleeping giant, that's right.
Yeah.
We'll get him.
Huh?
We'll get his name.
I think it was Kozumoto or...
Well...
Somebody out there will Google you.
All I know is somebody played his part in Tora Tora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was absolutely right, because Americans are at their best when they're the underdog, when they have to fight back to become number one again. And if someone planned that, they planned it brilliantly, because not only did we out-achieve the Soviets in terms of spacecraft and science and exploring the solar system and all that, but without Sputnik, we would not have gone to the moon. And remember, the real prize was the ancient artifacts of an extraordinary civilization waiting to be found and brought home and looted by Apollo on the moon that no one was supposed to talk about publicly. And you couldn't get an Apollo unless you made the Americans afraid that they were going to be second rate to those darn commies.
So true. So true. We're coming up to the break. When we come back, we're going to get right into this launch. And was von Braun, was he upset that the Russians, the Soviets beat us?
Oh, he was furious.
See, he didn't understand the big picture then, did he?
Well, he was, remember, he was part of this German contingent that were brought over, put to work, but not really trusted. He worked his way up in the army ranks, you know, with Medeiros and the Department of Defense, but he was not bosom buddies with Eisenhower. He was looked at as basically an enemy combatant who'd been brought over and put to work for the good guys.
Yamamoto,
yeah.
You got it. We'll be back.
See, we've got a great
team out there. They're quick.